This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, as always, Elwood Jones. And joining me, of course, is the Professor, Stephen Palmer.
Professor, indeed. Hello, Elwood. How are you tonight?
I'm very good. And tonight is the first part of our two-part special. And we are going over these two parts, going to be each giving our, how should we say this, our top 25, our personal favourite 25. It's, whenever you say give any sort of list on the internet, if you say, like, essential, it instantly leads to just angry emails being sent it to you as, how dare you call certain things essential. So these are our personal, together with the former list of our personal top 50 Asian cinema films. And I think over the course of these two parts, you're probably going to see there's some real sort of differences in between the films which interest myself and the films that interest Stephen. And tonight we're obviously going to be going through my own 25 picks, and then on the second part we're going to be going through Stephen's. The full list will be then put up on the blog, and you can obviously work your way through that and see how many you've seen yourself. But I'm excited already to see what's going to be on this list, because I think just in the sort of pre-production for this show, we've both gone very unique sort of routes and very sort of individual routes, and I have no idea what's on Stephen's list. And I sort of given Stephen a heads up prior to the show just of what's on mine, so it's quite exciting to obviously see what this list is going to be producing.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I hope comes out on the show normally is that we're both coming from very different places. So although quite often there's films that we both love, we're coming from very different cinematic places. I know you call me the professor because I'm highbrow and stuff like that, but also I think I'm very much more in the mainstream. Obviously the romantic comedies and things like that. Whereas, we'll see what's on your list, but there was a lot less crossover than I thought there was going to be.
Kicking off the list at spot 25 is Rainy Dog, directed by Takashi Miike. The middle part of his Shinjuku Triad Society trilogy, which has also been renamed in the meantime, since the film first came out. I mean, I saw this when it was released through Tartan's Asia Extreme label, and since then it's now released as a Black Society trilogy. And Rainy Dog is, for myself, the strongest of the three films, this being a trilogy connected by themes and ideas rather than characters. It's a very sort of traditional trilogy, and especially within Asian cinema, because when we look at trilogies in Asian cinema, they rarely, often than not, will carry across characters. They're more often just be about themes and ideas, as we saw with, like, Park Chan-wook's Vengeance trilogy. Rainy Dog itself, it sees a Japanese assassin who's been stranded in Taiwan and has been forced into taking a job from the local crime boss to make ends meet. And thrown into this mix, a woman from his past turns up with her son who claims belong to him. And this is, as I said, this is in the middle of Miike's outlaw period, and at the same time, while it's obviously got the bloodshed, it's got the heavy rain downfall, and we've got a man opening, I think in the opening 15 minutes, taking a wee off a roof while his genitals are blurred out in a haze of scratchy lines. At the same time, this is a film where you've got such magical moments of this little group discovering a scooter buried on the beach, which, well, not only are they able to dig out, but also seems to be full of fuel, and they're able to, in the next scene, see him riding down the road. So there's a lot to like about Rainy Dog, especially from the outlaw period for Miike, and I think this is a real sort of standout for myself and in that sort of key period for him. But Ian, what about yourself? Are you a fan of Rainy Dog? Or
as this won't be the first time I'm going to say this tonight, okay. I've never seen it.
Okay,
I haven't seen any of these three films. My Takashi Miike experience begins, probably a little bit later.
Yeah.
Which is surprising, because this is probably one of the films of his you thought I'd really like. So no, I'm coming at this it's a recommendation for me rather than something I can comment on.
At 24, Bill, we're going to obviously pick up Park Chan-wook, and that's Joint Security Era from 2000. This is a film which I think a lot of people tend to miss out on. It's really surprising when you think of how like big Park Chan-wook's county is. I mean, he's not only doing films over in his native Korea, but he's also doing films like Hollywood productions with things like Stoker. And yet, for some reason, we always seem to forget about Joint Security Era. And it's a real shame. A really interesting film where it focuses on the Joint Security Era, which separates North and South Korea. And it opens with kind of a little mystery where two North Korean soldiers have been killed, supposedly by one of the South Korean soldiers. And it sort of flashes back, and we discover that through the DMZ, that these soldiers have been forming a friendship, and they've been meeting in secret, even though their forces are heavily opposed to each other. And when they meet each other, when they're with their own forces, that they have to act like strangers to each other. And it's a really interesting look at people's beliefs. And it's just this idea that this country, which has obviously been split into North and South, with obviously the North being communist and South being capitalist, these soldiers finding common ground between the two and just forming this very unique friendship, and all the time having to hide the fact that their friends are obviously conducting these meetings in secret, and to obviously builds that sort of explosive climax. And I think Joint Security Era is definitely a real highlight on Park Chan-wook's strategy. It's more subtle than his Vengeance strategy, and certainly not as obsessed as like The Handmaiden, but there's a lot to enjoy there, and certainly has a lot of his sort of trademark style to it.
Yeah, I'm interested that you've picked this one, because it's Park Chan-wook's most mainstream film. Obviously, we could talk about the Vengeance trilogy, and we probably will over the next two episodes, and there's various outliers like Cyborg. But this is, I'm really surprised. I really like it. But it's a very, for me, it's a very by the numbers sort of military murder mystery that doesn't feel particularly Korean, except for the fact about the subject matter. It's got an amazing cast, though, with the always brilliant Song Kang-ho and the terribly handsome Lee Byung-hun and the incredibly beautiful Lee Young-ae. So for star watching, it's hard to beat. I mean, I think it's a very good film. I just wouldn't have it as one of Park's top movies, okay. But there's nothing wrong with it. It's hugely entertaining, and I absolutely hear what you're saying in the way that it's often forgotten about, because there's nothing wrong with it at all, and it certainly deserves to be talked about and watched.
I think this won't be the first time that I'm going to pick something unusual, and same when I was compiling this list, I tried to avoid, like, you know, those films which everyone says, oh, this is like an essential film, and just went with like what I like. Basically, it's more about picking the films I like rather than their critical acclaim or their cult following. So there's going to be some rather unique choices, I think, in this. And I think that's summed up by, especially by number 23, which is 2009's Fish Story by Yoshihiro Nakamura. This is a film which, when I first started watching it, I wasn't sure I was going to dig it. I stuck with it, and I'm really glad that I did. The film itself, it follows this song called Fish Story, which is written by this Japanese punk band, and the film follows a course of 37 years, and it follows this song and how it influences different people over the course of that period, as we go from this punk band writing it to right at the end where it plays a very key part in saving the Earth from total destruction from a giant comet that is heading towards us, which, in a fun little dig to Armageddon, it's noted that the American team sent up to disable the comet have failed miserably. So it's down to Japan to save the world from this giant comet. And it's fun just seeing the genre blending of styles, how this song constantly plays a part in these different characters' lives, and just how it weaves in and out over the course of this fairly 7-year period. And I think when you watch this film, you wouldn't think that it would be able to encompass like the genres and styles that it does. But yeah, it's certainly an unusual film, but one that once it all comes together and you see how it all ties together, it's just a really fun little film.
I've never seen this, but you have spoken about this film before, haven't you? I don't know whether on the podcast or maybe in a chat outside. It sounds absolutely fascinating, and I can't believe I haven't come across it before.
Yeah, this was one of those late night film four showings. So again, if you live in the UK, then always check that 1 p.m. slot for film four, because they're normally showing something good or something. Rather cult in that slot, and it's great for especially seeing these like one-off showings of like of Agent Zimmer, and especially as it seems to be where they've decided to put them, unless it's like a Ghibli movie. So, but no, Fish Stories, as I say, I believe Film Window Films put it out, and I don't think it's sort of been picked up by any of the other labels since. I think you can still get it through Third Window Films, so, but yeah, definitely hunt it down if you haven't, does it?
Yeah, I absolutely will. I mean, it's a director I don't know much about either, though he did a rather good film recently called The Inerasable, which is a sort of a horror mystery film, which is well worth checking out, but not as unusual as this one sounds.
Cool. Well, next up, we have got a film which I think a lot of people sort of dismissed just because they were so excited about Tokyo Tribe, and that's Why Don't You Play in Hell. Both films came out at around the same sort of time, and I don't, there's something about Why Don't You Play in Hell which just really sort of stood out for me. And I mean, Sion Sono as a director is, I think he's really sort of in the last couple of years really come into vogue. He's sort of picked up that mantle for like people who enjoyed like the Takashi Miike outlaw years have now sort of gravitated to checking out the films to Sion Sono, and he's sort of really running with it. He's just, for the man who obviously like was introduced to many people with like Suicide Club, he's just gone on to become increasingly like this really interesting director, and one who's not afraid to take risks. And certainly, as we've seen with like films like Love Exposure and Cold Fish, and even more recently, like Antiporno, which I really enjoyed, and Stephen, I think you didn't really like that much.
I had a problem with pretty much. So in this period, which started with Why Don't You Play in Hell and Tokyo Tribe, he put out something like 6 or 7 films in a 12-month period, of which Antiporno and Tag were 2. All of which, I like Tokyo Tribe, but all the others I have severe problems with. None of them were as bad as the stupid Virgin Psychics nonsense they did. But I thought Why Don't You Play in Hell was fine. Isn't it? I'm just trying to remember. Isn't it based on like an old script he had written way back before he was famous and sort of had the chance to dust it off and do it As a more established artist?
I believe so. I mean, the script, as you say, is completely bonkers. I mean, we've got this group of filmmakers who basically go around filming random things they see in the sort of town. They end up crossing paths with this Yakuza gang and decide that they're going to film the showdown between these two rival Yakuza gangs. And it's so visually interesting, and it goes off in many random directions. And I think the fact it is so random and throwing like references to like Kill Bill, we've got a scene where one of the characters uses world and samurai sword and like slashing people up, and they're like spurting rainbows, and oh, it's just so many fun elements in this film that I just really, really got a kick out of it. And it's, I think whenever we look at like humor, especially with an Asian cinema, this question whether it's going to translate or not, because some things do get lost in translation, especially more cultural sort of based things. And there was just something about Why Don't You Play in Hell that just really translated with and resonated with me. I just thought it was just a fun flick throughout. So,
yeah, again, it's a bit like when we talked about Joint Security Area. I think it's a really good, entertaining film. Not one of my favourite Sonos, but I absolutely understand why you in particular like it, because I think it's ticking a lot of your boxes. Whereas for me, I felt it was, I just felt it was a bit noisy, which some Sono films can be. And this comes from the guy that likes Tokyo Tribe, which is his noisiest one of all. So.
Yeah, I mean, with Tokyo Tribe, it's the fact is that you're watching people rap in Japanese. And while I loved all the craziness and all the action sequences, it's just like the rapping is like, I'm watching people rap in Japanese and following subtitles to understand it. It was like, there's just something not resonating there, even though I did really like the visual sort of style to it. So.
Yeah, no. I mean, of this, of sort of the six of this period, I mean, I think if anything defines the difference between you and I is that your favourite is this. I don't know. Have you got any other Sonos as we go up? Don't think so. Is this your only Sono?
I believe this is the only Sono that I've made the list.
Yeah. So my favourite, which was, I can't remember if it made my list or not. I don't think it did. I think it's Whispering Star.
Okay.
Which is like this stark, sort of sepia-toned, lo-fi science fiction film, which is really a meditation on life and death and humanity. And I think the fact that that's my favourite of this period of Sono's work, and this is yours. I think if you want to describe the difference between the two of us, that's it.
That brings us to 21, and this is a real throwback to Zomite. One of my sort of entry points and really my college years, and that's 1993's Ninja Scroll, a real sort of tempo title for anime. And here we've got obviously the masterless samurai Jubei, who is forced to team up with a rogue ninja to foil a plot to overthrow the government. This film sort of really sort of stands out to myself, mainly because it taps into that pop samurai vibe that I love so much, and the fact that we basically got this samurai anime, and at the same time basically has this hero Jubei, who's like, you know, the master swordsman, so he does all kinds of stupid and over the top moments throughout this, and he's basically forced to fight all these fantastical villains along the route to falling this plot to overthrow the government. And it's, you know, it's violent, and it contains so many sort of trademark things of like 90s anime that I think now have been sort of the push more to the back as we've sort of focus on more sort of like plot driven and cutesy things. And back in like 93 when the film was released, I mean, a lot of the anime that was coming across was really sort of like violent and oversexed, and I think it's why the, you know, it's led to a lot of pages sort of rustling from like, you know, the likes of the Daily Mail, who called for those to ban this sick filth. And it's also a time when we were calling over here, we were calling anime manga just because it was produced by Manga Entertainment. And I think over in America, they were calling it Japanimation. So it's interesting to obviously see that these sort of titles that laid the foundation for obviously all the anime that's followed. I think there's still as old school anime fans who still remember them. And I think there's just this younger generation who just forget that these movies exist. But Ninja Scroll is just phenomenally animated and just so much fun. Even if you're not like a big anime fan, you can just pick this up and enjoy it because it's just so action-packed and really quick-paced. So
it won't surprise you that I haven't seen this.
No,
because obviously we say pretty much every other episode, I'm not really an anime guy, and I'm certainly not this kind of anime guy. Yeah. If that makes sense. Obviously, it always seems to turn out I've watched far more animated movies than I like to admit. But it actually sounds really interesting. And if it's what I think it is, it's quite an influential piece on some Western cinema as well, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, you can see how it's influenced different elements. I think certainly, again, we're going to go constantly back to Kill Bill whenever you mention like pop samurai, because there were so much pop samurai references in Kill Bill. I think a number of these titles on my list will have been directly influenced in that film. But I think certainly when we look at like modern sort of media, I mean, if you look at like Samurai Showdown 2, pretty much most of the characters from this film were in there as playable characters. You can like look at films like things like Onimusha and even like Sudoku's Shadows Die Twice and just like see where the roots of like Ninja Scroll went. And it did inspire the knockoff Ninja Resurrection, which frustratingly was never finished, making it much like Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings. It has this amazing setup and it was just never finished, which is kind of unsurprising for a lot of 90s anime. And the fact that they would start projects and they would just never get finished. But yeah, I think Ninja Scroll, for some reason, it's just, even as I've got older and, I don't know, my tastes have kind of a little matured, shall I say. This is something about Ninja Scroll that's just constantly made me come back to it time and time again. So keeping on the martial arts theme, another really sort of influential film, and that's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon by Ang Lee. This film, released back in 2000, it was described as, by many people, as Sense and Sensibility with Kung Fu. An absolutely standout cast with both Chow Yun-fat and Michelle Yeoh. And even for, like, those martial, if you're a big martial arts fan, you obviously recognize the girl and swallow herself, Chang Pei-pei. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was one of those movies. I mean, it was released, obviously, subtitled, and I think a lot of people going into it had no idea what Wuxia films were. They certainly weren't expecting to have to sit through a big subtitle movie, and I think I saw more walkouts of this movie than I did it with many films of the time, but it really sort of ushered in a revival of interest in Hong Kong cinema and sort of paved the way for, like, Tarantino to push through his presentation version of Iron Monkey, which is also really, really cool. It's a Donnie Yen movie. But yeah, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it's, as I said, it's got that art house style to it, and at the same time has a lot of classic wuxia elements to it. And I didn't think that Ang Lee would be the director who would bring this, the man who was obviously giving us films like, you know, The Ice Storm and A Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. These sort of like artsy sort of picks. I think he was sort of the last person we'd expect to produce a really kick-ass martial arts movie. And Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I think it's a real sort of standout in martial arts cinema and a film that is well-deserving of its critical sort of reputation.
So we've spoken about this with Kim, haven't we? Whereas Kim and I think, have a similar view that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is like a really good cover version of wuxia movies. And I think it's everything you said is absolutely true. It's absolutely a touchstone movie because it did break over into the West. Did not win the Oscar for best film. I can't remember. It certainly was represented. And I went to the cinema to watch it when it came out, and the cinema was packed. I don't remember anyone walking out. And it's got some of the great names of both Hong Kong and Chinese cinema in it. It's beautiful to look at. I just didn't see an awful lot of originality in it myself. And those bits in the desert just seem to go on and on and on and on. I certainly didn't need a sequel, which I think Netflix thought we needed about 20 years too late. I mean, I think it's absolutely fine. But what I would use it as is a gateway into other wuxia films, including Iron Monkey, which is, I agree, absolutely fantastic. So this would be my route to go and look at the real deal rather than this polished cover version. But, you know, potato, potato.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously funny you mentioned, like, the desert sequence, because I know that the distributors weren't to cut it out, and Tarantino fought them to keep it in, arguing it was one of the best sort of sequences of the film. So I can see why people wouldn't want to, because it did feel like it was kind of, like, randomly slotted in there, this random flashback to Zhang Zi's character falling in love with this handsome this handsome bandit and the desert. And there's just so many sort of, like, set pieces in this, such as, like, you know, the battling on top of the bamboo, or when we look at, like, the training room sequence where we've got Michelle Yeoh and Zhang Zi battling out with different weapons. I think that they're just sort of, like, real sort of standout sequences, and the fact it's got this sort of, like, very traditional sort of soundtrack to it. It's not like they put, like, a modern soundtrack or anything on it. It's just like I pay a lot of right notes myself, so. And, you know, Michelle Yeoh with sharp weapons and murderous intent is just my thing.
Oh, I can't disagree.
On a slightly less classy note, number 19, we have Takashi Miike's Dead or Alive, the first part of his Dead or Alive trilogy. Right, a real sort of tempo for the outlaw period of Miike's films. This opens with one of the most eye-opening 15 minutes of cinema you will ever see, as we see people snort, like, mile-long lengths of coke, people having throat slits, stomachs exploding, assassinations, people falling off roofs, drug deals. It's just oh, you can print what most of them's managing, like a whole runtime he crams into 15 minutes. And
reality porn movies.
I know. And I mean, this is something when I was like, when describing this, I basically said this is like Mike remaking Heat, but just, you know, a lot shorter and a whole lot better. Here he's got like Rike Takeuchi and Sho Ekawa. Again, two real standout performers. And if you, especially if you like sort of like triad movies, you really will know with these guys like straight off. And the fact that Mike thought that their star status was like so high that in the final showdown, he couldn't decide who would actually win. So he just decides to eliminate all life on Earth. And that's how he ends this movie. And somehow he manages to get two sequels out of this, with these two actors battling each other across time and space. And yeah, I think the first Dead or Alive, it's certainly got that crime element, and it's got that wonderful opening, it's got that even more bizarre finale. But there's something about the story about, you know, this this triad boss and the cop who's like determined to bring him down. The story of the rivalry between these two is just really engrossing. And yes, there are obviously elements from Mike's that little period which do make it a little harder to recommend to sort of people who aren't familiar with his work, such as one of the characters gets drowned in a paddling pool of feces. And as I said, there's some really sort of random sort of moments throughout this film, which sort of like, I think if you're like a little more squeamish, may make it a bit more hard to say, but overall it is just a really fantastic and truly original crime movie.
No, I actually only saw it fairly recently. Someone did a box set of the three Dead or Alive movies, and I was trying to fill in those Takashi Miike gaps in my knowledge, and I was blown away by this. I think so everything I've said I didn't like about Why Don't You Play in Hell, I absolutely adore about this.
Yeah,
because contextually where it is in his career, and just have it, I mean, he's done a whole bunch of movies that are like weird crime movies, right?
That's right.
And but this is the epitome of it. This is the apex of weird shit Japanese crime movies. And like you say, that first 15 minutes is just the most amazing. If you want to say this is what Takashi Miike's about, show somebody those 15 minutes, and that shows you he's a proper filmmaker, not a, you know, a lot of his work was done early days or straight to video. And he's pumped out hundreds, literally over 100 movies, hasn't he, in his career? And in any other hands, that would be a hack. But those 15 minutes shows to me that the guy's a master of filmmaking. And even though it is shocking, and lots of shocking things happen, I didn't feel grossed out by any of it. I was just charmed by its imagination.
Yeah, it's... I love the fact that when Mike talks about his films from the outlaw period, especially the ones that he's like direct-to-video work, and in Japan there never seems to be the same sort of shame that we used to have for direct-to-video productions, and he describes it as making films of boys out in the countryside. So,
it's a different thing. I mean, the consumption of cinema in Asia is different, and it's just another way. And hilariously, I guess that's where we're going here in the West with straight to Netflix and things like that, where things which may never hit a cinema and they, you know, proper A-list directors may end up just distributing straight to other media and straight to streaming.
Yeah, and it's funny as well when we look at Mike as a director and we think of when he's producing these movies and things like Ishii the Killer, and now he's like producing such high quality work as like Person Assassins. You would not think it's the same director. The fact that, I mean, he's now working at a level which is as where it feels like he's like one of the top respected directors, not only in Japan, but to the West as well. He's like completely shifted once he entered that outlaw period. Now gone into more of a sort of mainstream period, and yes, are those detractors who wish that he was still making these sorts of movies, but I'm just still excited every time he, like, you know, that you're getting a new Mike movie. I mean, the fact he's passed over 100 films at this point it really sort of says something about this man's workload and the fact that he's the only one of the few directors who can pump out like 7 movies a year.
I mean, he's slowed down a fair bit, but he's still capable. You know, he does do those respectable anime and manga remakes, and he does do. I mean, he even does like romance films and things like that. I mean, he is not. We often think of him over here as sort of the master of the cult and the macabre. The guy's only ever made 2 horror movies, and out of 100 films, that's remarkable. I mean, he's made a lot of these crazy Yakuza films. I suspect that's about a third of his output. But you know, what we think of him is a fraction of what he is. He's a fascinating guy.
On a more classy note, is my next pick, and now obviously moving on to pick 18, and that's 1966 Tokyo Drifter by Seijin Suzuki. Again, another key influence on Kill Bill. If you ever wondered where the switch from colour to black and white came from, that would be Tokyo Drifter, as this film randomly switches from colour to black and white and then back to colour again, mainly because when they were filming the production, they just were using any sort of film stock they could get their hands on, and it creates this really interesting art house effect. The film itself, it follows Yakuza Boss Kira, who's dissolved his own criminal empire, and a rival kingpin offers the position to Katara's top operative, Tetsuo, Phoenix Tetsu Honda. And when the fiercely loyal Tetsu declines, Otsuko taps the unstoppable Tetsu the Viper, who's a ruthless gun for hire to assassinate him. And as the Viper trails his target through the countryside, the agile Phoenix Tetsu grows concerned for one of his former associates has betrayed him. This is really my entry point into the sort of films of Suzuki, and he's one of those directors I'm still working my way through. I've only seen a few films of his, things like Branded to Kill and The Fight of Delinquents. So he's still a director I'm discovering, but Tokyo Drifter is really a fun little gangland thriller. It's, as I said, from the surface, it may look a little artsy, but just the actual direction and the set design and just the style is so cool. This movie is just well worth discovering. And I think if you're looking for an entry point into his work, he has got a very extensive back catalogue. I think that Tokyo Drifter, it, much like Brandon Disco, is just a really nice entry point for this one, so for this director.
Yeah, this isn't my favourite Seijin Suzuki film. You've mentioned the one that I love the most, which is a Branded to Kill, which I suspect we'll be talking about in the next, somewhere in the next 25 episodes. one of us will bring it up, I'm sure. There's a whole genre of cool Yakuza movies. And he brings to them, I don't know, a really weird visual style, humor, but cool. You sort of know you're watching one of his films. So yeah, I'd recommend this one.
Staying with the Japanese masters, my next pick is Keiji Mushu the Shadow Warrior from Akira Kurosawa. Kurosawa, unquestionably one of the masters of Japanese cinema. And whenever we produce these sort of lists, I think a lot of people either go like Front of Blood or Seven Samurai, and they miss off completely Keiji Mushu, which is really kind of surprising. I mean, this is a film that was executive produced by both George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola, no doubt because of the amount that both of those men owe their visual sort of style to the work of Kurosawa. I think certainly with Lucas, he owes like a whole franchise to Kurosawa, obviously with Hidden Fortress now being so well known as the inspiration for Star Wars. The film itself, it is one of those feudal epics, and we've got an aging warlord who dies and he's replaced with an imposter, and it's basically about this ruse to basically avoid the rival sort of warlords from attacking. They keep this ruse that he's still alive, and the film itself is very sort of like, it's very sort of character driven, so it's not the most action packed of movies, but it does have one of the most astounding final shots of any of the Kurosawa movies, as it just takes a wide lens to a battlefield sequence. And I think Keiji Mushu is certainly just it's one of my favorites of the Kurosawa back catalogue. I mean, it's a back catalogue which has got so many sort of undisputed classics in it, but I think I'd rather give the Nod to Keiji Musha and have more people discover it than, you know, just go with like one of the old favorites.
Yeah, that's another really interesting choice by you. I mean, obviously, there was going to be a Kurosawa on this list, on your list, or on my list, or one of our lists for sure. And obviously, the sort of thing that inspired us to do this was that other BBC list, wasn't it? Which is full of Kurosawa movies.
Yeah.
This is a really good one. And like you say, you could have pointed people at Rashomon, you could have pointed people at Ran, you could have pointed people at all sorts of things. The joy of Kurosawa is most of his films are just really, really good. So even the ones which aren't Jidageki period dramas, I think you could have thrown a dart at a Kurosawa dartboard and come up with a perfectly valid choice.
Awesome. Well, that's reassuring. Probably on the, again, we're still on the samurai track, but it's a pop samurai track. And that's Baby Card of Peril at the River Styx. Or Baby Card at the River Styx, should I say. This is the second film in the Lone Wolf and Cub series. The film itself, following the Shogun, Shogun's personal assassin, as him and his infant son Diego travel through the land that they call Hell. This is, I think, called the film which I think when a lot of people talk about their favourite of the saga, this is a real sort of the one which a lot of people gravitate towards. It was also a key influence for the film Big Trouble in Little China, as the Lords of Death are basically the visual inspiration for the Three Storms. If you, for the longest time, I mean, Shogun Assassin was the only sort of cut we have of this, which basically took the first film and the majority of this film and edited it together. And I mean, I still argue that Shogun Assassin is not without its charms. I mean, you get all the great best bits of both films in one film. But I think if you're watching them for what they are, then certainly Baby Cart the River Styx is just an absolute standout. Just seeing our hero, Ogami Eto. As I said, this was originally an executioner for hire for the Shogun, and now he's basically, after his wife was assassinated, has gone on this sort of rampage of bloody revenge. And in this film, it's got highlights such as a group of female ninjas who, when they're recruited for the job of assassinating him, challenge one of the sort of henchmen of their new employer to basically walk down an alleyway, and he's slowly hacked to pieces, so just his head rolls the end of the pathway, and just the Lords of Death themselves with the big sort of rice paddy sort of hats on, and their sort of like weapons, which include like a club and wolverine claws, and just really really cool to see. And yeah, it's fun, bloody action. It's a pop samurai movie, so it's not the most highbrow of films, but I think it's a real sort of standout and one worth checking out, especially with like fun samurai movies.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I kind of grew up with the Lone Wolf and Cub manga, which was, I guess, reprinted by Dark Horse when I was sort of 15, 16, 17. And of course, which is the same material that these films are based on. I mean, I couldn't pick one above any of the others, like picking your favourite child, isn't it? They're all a huge amount of fun. You know, it's fascinating what drama and action you can eke out of a disgraced samurai and a baby in a cart and make something like six films about them. And each one of them is unique, has got something different about it. So, as you say, this is probably the standout one. This is the one most people would know. But don't forget, there's plenty of other movies in this series which are all equally as fun and enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely, especially when it comes to Baby Cart, which has got so many hidden weapons and gadgets on it, it would make Q blush. It's like, if James Bond ever needed a stroller, this would be his stroller of choice, for sure. On to the next pick, we are now on to number 15, and that's Where the Dragon from 1972. Absolute standout film from Bruce Lee. Now, when I'm obviously coming to pick my third Bruce Lee movies, I was going to obviously go with Enter the Dragon, you know, that standout classic. And I thought, well, we can't really pick Enter the Dragon because it's a bit of a Western movie. And certainly when you look at his films that he made through Golden Harvest, I think Where the Dragon's the absolute standout here. And see, is sent to Rome to help his cousins in their restaurant business, and they're being pressured by the local crime syndicate. And the sort of standout to this movie is the fact that we get to see the double nunchucks, the sequence which was hacked to bits by the BBFC in the UK, only being restored in the sort of early 2000s, as the sort of head of the BBFC at the time was really sort of frowned on Eastern weaponry. So the mere sight of nunchucks, especially two being wielded by the master, Bruce Lee, was a real sort of like no-no. The film is also really noteworthy for featuring Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris having a fight to the death in a Roman Colosseum. There's a number of videos on there where people have like dissecting it, and I've seen like sort of like martial arts commentators like really sort of break down the scene. So there's a really good scene to just sort of dissect and stuff. Chuck Norris sadly obviously loses, so, but you know, this is Chuck Norris without the beard. So, you know, without his beard of power, it was always inevitable. He was never going to be Bruce Lee. The story behind, obviously, that final showing down being really fantastic, as Bruce Lee basically phoned up Chuck Norris and said, how do you feel about coming to Rome and having a fight to the death with me in a Roman Colosseum? And he's like, I'm on my way. Where the Dragon, real sort of standout for myself. I think at the Golden Harvest sort of films, I think Where the Dragon's always going to be my favourite at that period.
And there was always going to be a Bruce Lee film on this list, right?
I think it's inevitable. We have.
I think you know, if you're going to have Kurosawa as the director of Asia, you're going to have Bruce Lee as the megastar. You know, his CV may be small, but his importance as a Chinese icon is not negotiable. So. Yeah, wouldn't have been the one I picked, but I think you've got a small pool there to pick from. And you're absolutely right, sort of the Bruce versus Chuck Norris, it's iconic in and of its own right, isn't it?
Oh, there's just so many parts of that sequence. It's not just like a straight up fight of them just like throwing blows at each other. There's just so many like small details, the way that when he defeats him at the end, he covers over his opponent. It's that mark of respect. And this was always the thing with Bruce Lee's films. There was all these like different philosophical elements that Lee put into the fights. They weren't just like, oh, I'm just this invincible tough guy who's just going to batter 500 guys. There's always these like these philosophical elements. And as I said, just the way that these two battle, these two martial arts masters, is just absolutely astounding to see. So definitely one worth checking out, if just for that scene alone. So. The next pick on the list at number 14 is the film which started it all for us here on the Asian Cinema Film Club, and that's 1995's Ghost in the Shell by Mamoru Oshii. Again, when we talk about the temples of anime, then Ghost in the Shell is unquestionably up there. I would say it's my second favourite anime of all time. The film itself was remade recently with, I would say, a passable Hollywood remake. I liked it. I think the critics didn't, but... The film itself, it follows this group of cybernetic cops, from Section 9, as they're trying to track down a hacker known as the Puppet Master. And it brings up a lot of interesting sort of philosophical questions about, you know, what a soul is and what it is to be human. And at the same time, throws in a lot of fun sort of like cyberpunk elements into the mix. And it's one of those entry points for myself when it came to anime, and it's a film that I still return to myself, which find myself returning to like time and time again. I think it's a really great story, fantastically animated, and a real sort of standout for Mamoru Oshii's sort of resume. As I mean, he obviously gave us things like Planetball, which is also really cool as well. But Ghost in the Shell is just still an absolute standout, and we started the show with it. And I think I'm still happy that was the first film we chose to review on this, because I think it's still a really important work.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the US remake as well. I think we were contemporaneous with that release. I thought it addressed head on some of the issues that other people had with it, and I thought it was very good. My opinion hasn't changed 180 degrees from when we first talked about it. I think it's a movie which is more interesting in the subjects and discussion points that it raises what, you know, sort of about souls and what it is to be human,
yeah,
than maybe the quality of the animation, maybe the quality of the story. But, you know, it's a tentpole of anime. It's one of the gateway three, yeah? Or gateway four. You had to have one of these on the list. And absolutely, I approve.
13 now, and the next title I'm going to talk about is Audition from 1999, Takashi Miike. And I think we said on episode 25, our most recent episode, that when we look at the films which re-sparked the interest in Asian cinema, the so-called Asian Invasion, it was this film, Battle Royale, and Ring, that really sort of revived the interest in Asian cinema. And Audition is really an interesting sort of movie, especially for Takashi Miike, because it was quite like anything else he was doing at the time, as it's a very sort of movie, and it's one movie which constantly makes the top, like, scary moments of all time, just for its finale. But I think if you go into it expecting this straight out gore fest, you're going to be seriously disappointed, as this is a very subtle, a very sort of slow burning film, as we have this ad executive who is basically holds a fake audition to try and find a new partner, and in doing so he encounters this sort of like really entrancing girl called Sami, who has got a bit of a dark past, should we say, and it's only over the course of the film that we find out just how dark that past is. Yes, this film is as I say, it's a lot more subtle than a lot of Miike's films of the period, but it still has those shocking moments, as we see limbs amputated by cheese wire, as well as a sequence involving a man in a sack, which I think if you're eating, probably best pausing the movie for.
So this was the movie that we met over, I guess.
It was, yes.
Well, back on the Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know cult list, the long lamented and replaced with 15 other podcasts that you now do. And there's probably not been a film I've spoken about or written about more than this. I maintain it's not a horror movie. A lot of people think it is. I think it's a dark psychological thriller that starts off almost like a comedy, although a pretty twisted one. The more you think about it, the worse it is. The novel's really good. Ryo Murakami's novel. It's a little bit different, but broadly, if you a Takashi Miike adaptation, this is absolutely really reined in. One could even argue it's a little boring in the first act and a half, and then that sack thing happens. And although spoiled in the trailer, unfortunately, but this was absolutely, like you say. There was this, there was Ring, there was Battle Royale. And these were the films that Tartan presented to us. These are the films that got reviewed in the magazines. These are the films which reawakened certainly Japanese, let's call it cult cinema, in the West. It reawakened in me as well. I was already into Asian cinema, but I'd kind of gone away. And then these movies reawakened that interest for me. Is it a film that I'd necessarily watch over and over? Probably not, but it's just really important and therefore has to be on this list from one of us.
We're now on pick 12, which is Police Story from 1985, another standout title, especially for martial arts cinema and also for Jackie Chan. Here who plays the framed police officer, who is sets out to clear his name. This film, I think, is so influential, not only because it introduced a lot of people in the West to Jackie Chan, and more keenly his desire to constantly put himself in ever-increasing amounts of danger. When it comes to, obviously, Jackie Chan's stunt work, I mean, this is really sort of head and shoulders above so many of his other films. He just goes all out in this film. These throwing himself off banisters, he's engaged in car chases, and there's so many sequences you can see that have been borrowed for other films in the West. I mean, there's an opening shot in the The shot in the opening where they're having a car chase through this village and they're sort of smashing through the buildings. And when you look at Bad Boy 2, it's like, oh, that looks very familiar. And it says finale, which also featured a very similar sequence. And I mean, this kicked off the SuperCop series. I think it's arguably the best of the series. I mean, SuperCop 3 is also pretty cool as well, as is the likes of First Strike. So. But I think time and time again, if I'm asked to like, which is my best sort of Jackie Chan movie, I think Police Story time and time again is sort of the one I keep coming back to. And it's just an absolutely jaw-dropping film, just like is as impressive for its martial arts work as it is for its stunt work, unquestionably.
I used to have a real problem with Jackie Chan. The modern Jackie Chan is not necessarily a nice fella, and I hadn't really watched many of his movies, and then someone nagged me to death and got me to watch. No, it wasn't you. It was pre-Elwood. But they nagged me to death. Oh, Jackie Chan, you must watch Police Story. And I watched Police Story, and I was utterly blown away. It's the stunt work, the energy, Chan's charisma. They all add up to just an amazing... I mean, it's just a fun movie. But then when you add to the fact he's doing all these bloody stunts, and it's just an incredible energy about it. All this, plus you get Maggie Cheung and Bridget Lin. I mean, it was originally on my list as well, but I would have had it higher, frankly, because I think it's we talked about the tentpole of anime. I think this is a tentpole of Hong Kong cinema, and certainly Jackie Chan's finest moment.
Pulling just short of the top 10, though, at number 11 is Satoshi Kon's Paprika from 2006. This film is like a real key inspiration for Inception, as basically we have this Febris he goes under the name of Paprika, who's able to access people's dreams. And basically she's, when the machine which allows people to enter patients' dreams is stolen, she sets out on this very surreal quest with a detective to try and figure out who told it. And it's a world that gets ever more sort of bizarre and surreal as it goes on. But this is just absolutely stunning anime. The animation is fantastic. The soundtrack alone is so good that I have it on my Spotify that I occasionally like tap into it when I need something a little upbeat. But Satoshi Kon, a director who was taken to us way too soon, unfortunately passing away from cancer, but leaving in his wake probably one of the most perfect filmographies, I would say. Time and time again, we saw this obsession with sort of dreams and surreal worlds. We saw it in Perfect Blue, we saw it in Paranoia Agent. And certainly the film he was working on prior to his death was titled Dreaming Machine. So it really sort of emphasized where he was going with that one. But I think, you know, one of those talents that I think we lost way too soon. So Satoshi Kon is just a really wonderful director, and certainly one of my favorites, especially with anime. And Paprika was one of those films, I think, when I saw it, I just straight off was like, just wanted to watch it again. As soon as those credits were, I just wanted to just dive back into this movie again, and it holds up to repeat viewings, which is always nice to see as well. And sometimes when we get these sort of flashy movies, they just sort of fall apart when you watch them again, but Paprika just time and time again is just a really wonderful experience.
So it's not my favourite Kon movie. It's a fantastic novel as well. So it's based on a novel by, let's have a look, Yasutaka Tsutsui. I've mangled that. But yeah, it's a visual treat. And absolutely, if you've watched Inception, go back and watch this and see where Christopher Nolan got some of his ideas from. Couldn't recommend it more, mate.
Cool. Now we're obviously into the top 10. So these are like the key sort of titles, my own film watching interest. And kicking things off is from 2002. It's Infernal Affairs, directed by Alan Mack and Andrew Lowe. This film was obviously most noteworthy for being remade as The Departed, the film which won Scorsese's Oscar. this is the first part of a trilogy, but for myself, the first film is the one that sort of stands out the most. Number two being the prequel, and three being sort of like the finale to wrap everything up. But just on its own, Infernal Affairs is just a really fantastic film, as we obviously have the a young police officer being sent under to act as a mole with the local triads. At the same time, the triads have sent their own mole in to infiltrate the police force. And this, when I said when we talk about like star casts, I think this film is just astounding, the cast that they have for it. So I mean, we've got Andy Lau, we've got Tony Leung, Anthony Wong, Eric Toussaint, Kelly Chan. There isn't a bad person in this whole cast, and I feel for myself it's far superior than The Departed. I think the plotting in this film is a lot tighter, the characterization's a lot more sort of intense, and it doesn't sort of clog up the works by having unnecessary characters. And certainly the chemistry when we see this sort of, we see Angelo and Tony Leung finally face off, is just in that finale sort of sequence, is just really sort of fantastic. Anthony Wong, here playing a good guy for a change, and for his, you know, finally getting to play the good guy, and what does he get for it? Well, he gets thrown off a roof. So that worked out well for him. But I mean, we've talked already about ourselves, you know, we connect him through films and how, you know, we've met through my previous podcast, My Bad and Darren Strange Showcase. And I may put that archive episode up on the blog, just so people can check it out if they want to. And this, we're through Infernal Affairs. I mean, this is how I met my other co-host, Kim, over on Game Warp and Movies and Tea. And it was through this, her coming on us, discussing this film and SPL, that, you know, that friendship started. So I owe a lot to Asian Cinema. I made some of my, some great connections and met some awesome co-hosts through Asian Cinema. And Infernal Affairs is one of those movies that sort of came out big sort of hype, and it's one of those films that actually lives up to its hype.
It's a fantastic, iconic, brilliantly plotted movie that just, to me, it kind of sums up sort of it's almost the end of that golden era of Hong Kong cinema. Like you say, the cast is amazing. I mean, you've named them all already, really, haven't you? But it's all right. I mean, I'll add to that. It's got Chapman Toe in it, who's always good value for money. It's got little brief glimpses of Sean Yu and our old friends Pervy Edison Chen, who would go on to star in the prequel. But it's all there already in the in this film. The gun standoff at the top of the building is iconic. There's even two different endings. You can watch the real ending or the Chinese ending, when different people win. Although that does kind of mess up the third film. If you've only ever watched the Chinese ending, you must wonder what's going on. But it's just got a fantastic cast, a fantastic idea, a fantastic plot. I'm a big fan of The Departed. I know a lot of people think it's sort of a Scorsese sort of pity Oscar. But I kind of enjoy it. But this is much tighter. The sequels were worth it. Both sequels are fine, but this film, head and shoulders, and it's to me just like a gold standard for sort of Hong Kong modern police action films.
The next one at number 9 may come as a little bit of a surprise to regular listeners to the show, and that's 1954's Gojira by Ishiro Honda. Yes, I have put a Godzilla movie at number 9. I know that a lot of people would have expected this to be my number 1, but it's not. It's unquestionably a masterpiece, and the film which obviously gave us the giant radioactive lizard who's gone on to have an illustrious career, you know, as the king of kaiju monsters. He's got his own star on the Hollywood Boulevard, and the honour of being asked to direct a Godzilla movie holds the same honour to Japanese directors that being asked to direct a Bond movie does to British directors. And, I mean, when we talk about, if I had like my Mount Rushmore of sort of cult essential directors, then Ishiro Honda would be on there, right up between Todd Browning and Abel Ferreira for myself. And the film itself is a real, unlike the other ones, which are sort of like giant chopped socky movies, is giant monsters battling each other and stomping on Tokyo. It's a very sort of sober monster movie, as this mythical sort of creature, Gojira, turns up and basically starts going on a little bit of a rampage, should we say. And the film is still peppered with so many like sober moments. We see shots of field hospitals. We've got that now iconic shot of the mother hugging her children as like debris rains down upon us. It's like, don't worry, we'll see your father soon. And it's so different than the other films in which followed in its wake. But at the same time, it's just such a masterpiece, and it sort of stands on its own. And you can understand why this is a legendary film that it is. It's not just this hokey giant monster movie. It's just really intelligent filmmaking, absolutely stunning camera work. I mean, Honda, he would obviously go on to direct many of like the key movies in the Toho back catalog. He would direct like Rodan and Mothra, including like obviously more sort of like one-off sort of creations such as like Vartan. And his work in this film is so essential to setting up everything that followed, and I think without it we wouldn't have obviously the legacy of Godzilla that we do now.
Yeah, everything you just said and more. Obviously you're the kaiju guy, but this film is transcendent of that. It's a really well-made science fiction movie, and there aren't a lot of proper science fiction movies in Asian cinema. It's not a genre that they do a lot of because of budgets and things like that. So yes, if your knowledge of Godzilla is the more campy side of things, this will come as a shock. It's a very sober movie. It's got a lot to say about the nuclear fear and the nuclear peril that Japan obviously feels stronger than anybody. And it just looks stunning in black and white. It doesn't look like, it doesn't always look like model work or people in suits. There's a palpable fear. The more recent Shin Godzilla tried to tap into that and still couldn't do it. It's a unique experience, and yeah, just a fantastic film.
Cool. Right, so number 8 is Toshikon again with Perfect Blue from 1997. Surprisingly, I think where the timing of the period, I think sort of anime on itself was kind of sort of waning in interest, but I think Perfect Blue served to revive some of that interest, and I think it's just an absolutely stunning film, and it's only one which announced Kon as being this talent to watch. The film itself, it follows this pop singer called Mima, who decides that she's going to retire and become an actress. And at the same time, a website appears called Mima's Room, which details her life as if she had continued as a pop star. And it goes down into this nightmare-ish world where she's not sure what's real and what's fake. And it would prove a key influence on Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan. There's so many shots that he would include in that film which mirror up with Perfect Blue, and then he also borrowed shots as well for Requiem for a Dream. And this is just a really interesting psychological thriller. I think it showed that anime could be more than, you know, just giant bosom ultra vixens and huge robots and demons and schoolgirls and all these things that we associate as being anime. And it showed that you could tell really intelligent filmmaking, so really intelligent stories, and just really interesting ideas just through the medium. So yeah, I mean, Perfect Blue is, again, it's just one of my favorites of the Shikon filmography, and I said that's why I've ranked it at number 8.
And of course we've spoken about this movie at length on a previous episode. However, this is an exceptional film, and the fact it is an anime is irrelevant. This would have been, if it had been done properly, would have been a fantastic live-action film. So we'll pretend the live-action one doesn't exist, right? the story, I mean, this film's getting on for 30 years old.
Getting up there.
But it's as relevant now as it was then, with what it's talking about, celebrity and stalking and loss of identity because of celebrity. It's properly adult. There are some things in it which I find a little distasteful. There's a little bit of rapiness and a bit of fan service going on. Let's be honest about you. The guy who we may think is the bad guy, the animation is a bit too literal in what it's trying to visualize. But it's just a fantastic film, and you can watch this, and this isn't watching Frozen. This is watching a grown-up adult film. It just so happens that the actors and actresses in it are drawn and not living and breathing. It's a brilliant movie.
At number 7, we have a film which I absolutely adored, Stephen Dinn, and that's John Woo's Hard Boiled. Hard Boiled is, whenever I talk about John Woo's sort of films, I always recommend that people check out the films in this order and go watch A Better Tomorrow, then The Killer, and then watch Hard Boiled. And Stephen, I mean, you chose to just skip right to the end and watch Hard Boiled for some reason.
Well, you know.
It's the rebel that you are.
If you tell me to do something, I'll do the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as we look at Scorsese and his working relationship with Robert De Niro, John Woo and Chow Yun-fat is just another genius partnership. And here, I think both are working, just firing on all cylinders. As Chow Yun-fat plays the detective Tequila, who is the sort of detective who shoots first and asks questions later, going up against the evil crime boss played by Anthony Wong. This film is just an absolute bullet ballet of gun-fu. It's so stunning and features all the trademarks that you want from a John Woo movie, including a 40-minute showdown in a hospital, which is being used as a secret gun storage for the local crime boss. And this is a sequence which has no repetition and just no sort of breaks at all. It does continuous firefighting. It's the inventiveness and just the style that John Woo brings to this film is just absolutely astounding, and features in its high point Detective Keeler running through a burning hallway carrying a baby caught on fire, only to have his flames put out by the baby weighing on his leg. And he says, "Thanks, kid, your piss put out my flames." And if that doesn't make you want to see this film, I don't know what does.
So, yeah, you can go back to our previous episodes and see what I think of this. Don't get me wrong, I appreciate the art. And in terms of set pieces and sort of those John Woo ticks, shall we say,
They're
all here in spades. You've got Chow Yun-fat, Anthony Leung, who are both superstars. So on one level, it's a fantastic film. Unfortunately for me, the story was such a bag of nonsense and so easy to unpick and left me with so many questions from minute one through to minute 90 or however long it is, just stopped me really enjoying it. But I absolutely understand the art. I understand what a genre fan will get out of this. I totally get why people think it's so great. I just don't think it is.
At number 6, we have our first entry from Studio Ghibli, and it's Hayao Miyazaki's 1997 film Princess Mononoke. This is a really fun fantasy movie and one of the first movies that was picked up for distribution through Disney. At the same time, now giving that legendary story of Miyazaki sending a samurai sword to the Disney offices saying no cuts after the treatment that Valley of the Wind had received being hacked to bits by New World Pictures. The film itself, as I said, is well funded by Disney. I don't think they knew what they were getting, as this is a film fantasy movie where it taps into that Miyazaki popular theme of nature versus industry, as we have the forest spirits teaming up to battle Lady Eboshi, who's leading the forces of industry, and the two coming into conflict. At the same time, you have the young warrior Ashika, who is basically trying to cure his cursed hand, which it gets cursed during the opening attack by a demon boar god, a sequence which took over a year to animate. And it's just so stunning to think that this isn't CGI, this is hand-drawn animation. And you, if people ever question why Miyazaki is as revered as he is as a director, especially of animation, and the fact that they can like lessen his reputation by calling him the Disney of the East, because he's certainly not. He's an absolute master director, especially of animation. And Princess Mononoke is just an absolute standout title of the Ghibli back catalogue.
I'm surprised you chose this one, but then at the same time, I'm not surprised. Yeah, I mean, everything you said plus more. It's not my favourite Ghibli film. It's probably not even in my top five.
Okay.
I've got one in my 25, which isn't this. And it's not Spirited Away. It's not Kiki's Delivery Service. And it's not Only Yesterday, which are my other favourites. But this would be in my, yeah, this, okay, this might be my top five Ghibli. I mean, it's a stunning piece of work. But so are they all. And again, I suspect it was a bit like choosing your favourite child. But
you have no idea how close I came to putting Kiki's Delivery Service on. Kiki's Delivery Service is just an enchantingly wonderful movie. It's actually one of those few Ghibli movies where I prefer the dub to the subtitle version. And I think it's just mainly because the cat's a little more fun and sarcastic in the dub version than he is in the subtitle version. And Kirsten Dunst providing the voice of Kiki is just really great as well. It sort of that was a great thing about Disney picking them up, is the fact they got these A grade actors to obviously do the voice acting.
Absolutely, got A list. They do have A list dubs. I mean, you can't go wrong with these movies. And actually, interestingly, these are Japanese films which I don't mind listening to a dub. Strangely, I don't know why. I mean, I guess Spirited Away is the one which really branched out and crossed over to the mainstream more. But I understand absolutely why you like this one. And you're absolutely right. It's a lot darker than maybe what they thought they were getting.
Right. So now into our top five. And number five is an entry from Park Chan-wook's Vengeance Trilogy. And I'm going to sort of rock the boat here by saying that my favourite of the Vengeance trilogy is Lady Vengeance, also known as Sympathy for Lady Vengeance from 2005. Here we see Lee Kwang-ja, who is imprisoned for the murder of a six-year-old boy. And over the course of the 13 years, she forms all kinds of contacts with her fellow inmates who teach her various skills or give her abilities that enable her to extract her revenge on the people who led for her to be falsely imprisoned. Lady Vengeance, I think, while a lot of people will obviously go towards Old Boy, and even fewer still will mention the rather still wonderful for Mr. Vengeance, there was something about Lady Vengeance that just really stood out for me, be it Blood on Snow, the really sort of iconic makeup and look that we see here for our main heroine of sorts. And or it could just obviously be the finale, the final revenge sequence, where we have this group of parents who are just sitting in a hallway, like they're lined up for like a parents' evening, but they've all got different weapons, and how they choose to extract revenge on the final guy is just probably one of the most chilling moments of revenge cinema. But it's peppered at the same time with moments of black humour, such as one of the parents charging at this guy with an axe, only for his wife to stop him and say, "No, you can't kill him. There's other people behind us waiting." But no, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, I just love the fact that we have this character who, by doing good deeds, in turn gains the respect and the sort of skill sets of her fellow sort of inmates. So one who's part of a husband and wife bank robbing team, sets her up so she can get a weapon of choice, which is this really elaborate gun, and others sort of like teach her different sort of skills that she can use on the outside world. And right from the opening, where she rejects eating tofu, which is the symbolizing of cleansing, a cleansed soul, the film itself sets her off as like this really sort of driven person. And we see her, how she like enters as this like really sort of nice and naive woman, and she comes out this really sort of like cold and calculating killer. I think it's just a really fascinating movie, and I think it's just like the perfect final finale for Park Chan-wook's Vengeance trilogy. And I think Vengeance has never looked as beautiful as it does in these films.
So, spoilers for my list. I pick another one of the Vengeance trilogy.
Ooh, which one?
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil it that much. I half love Lady Vengeance. The first half of the movie, the colourful half, even though there's a fucking child murder that's the root of it, there's something about Park Chan-wook's use of colour, use of imagery, use of humour, as you say. It's almost like a heist, isn't it? Getting the gang together and doing it all. And it's absolutely delightful. And then the film goes somewhere, as you've already said, really freaking dark. And although there are elements of humour in it, the colour of the movie drains out. And so I actually find it really hard to watch. I think, is there not a version where it starts in colour and ends in black and white? Is that not how it was originally going to be done? But I mean, the palette he uses anyway, it darkens. And I feel guilty about enjoying the first half of the movie.
Okay.
Because the second half is so grim. And that's the problem I have with the film, is that I adore the first half and then feel awful with myself because of what happens in the second half. It's hard to explain. I have a really strange relationship with the movie. I mean, you could put on the first 40 minutes and I'll be happy as a sandboy. But then it goes somewhere too dark for me to contemplate.
Next up on the list, we have the highest rated Godzilla movie of my listener. Number four is 1968's Destroyer Monsters, a film which also marked our very first Kaiju Christmas. Destroyer Monsters, or also known as Attack of the Marching Monsters, is the ninth entry in the Godzilla series, and at the time was actually designed to be the final Godzilla movie. And at that point, the boss at Toho were ready just to put the whole series into mothballs and, you know, be done with it. But the success of this film made it not only one of the most popular films of the Showa series, but also meant that the film has gone on for some 19 plus movies since. The film itself, it taps into all the usual sort of trends of the period. So we've got space travel and alien invasion, and we also have basically every monster that belonged in the Toho catalogue, bar their version of King Kong, being brought out for this giant monster smackdown, with the absolute sort of standout Godzilla moment of all time being the six monsters teaming up to take on King Ghidorah for the finale. This film, if you're a fan of like kaiju movies, will be just, you know, an absolute fanboy dream. As not only do we get Godzilla, we get like such classics such as Mothra, we get King Ghidorah, we get Angulus, we get Rodan, and we get even like one-shot characters like Spigra and Baragon and Manda. And it really just gave so much to the franchise in the fact that we got given Monsterland, where all the monsters in the world have now been rounded up and they're stored on this one island. And it just added so much to the saga. It now meant that we were never wondering where these monsters are, because it's not like a pair of keys. It's not a giant monster is not something you can just misplace. So the fact that they're all on this one island, sort of time and time again, just was a really nice sort of addition to the series. And I think certainly when I talk about like recommending a Godzilla movie to someone who's never seen one before, then I always recommend Destroyer Monsters as being like the entry point, because it's got so many fun elements. It's giant monsters destroying major cities around the world, having giant smackdowns with each other, and there's just a lot of fun there. And it's got a really cool cast as well, and would be one of the final films for the main Godzilla sort of forefathers to all work on together. And here we just have like a lot of people just working really at the height of their powers, like including Ishiro Honda. We've also got a wonderful score by Makira Ikafumi as well. But you know, Destroy Monsters is just one of those movies I just return to time and time again, and certainly that's why it is where it is on my list. It probably would be higher if the films which obviously preceded it didn't just sort of edge it out.
So this didn't surprise me. I thought this was going to be your number one. I love this film as well. It's like a greatest hits movie, isn't it? Of
yeah.
Of Godzilla movies after the first one. So if you're able to park your brain somewhere else and not worry too much about these rubber suited men, and also don't worry too much about not knowing who all these characters are, all these monsters are, which obviously you have religious fervor over, Elwood. but for the rest of us, oh, that's a cool one. That's not such a cool. But it's brilliant. It's got the concept of Monster Island, which I think is just fantastic, and I wish people did more with. But I do believe the next bunch of Western remakes are going to have a look at that, and hopefully they'll do something good with it. But it's just fun, and it's fun. It's not campy though. It's not. So some of the Godzilla movies after this get campier and campier, or even before this. But this is just fun. This is what filmmaking can be.
Yeah.
So if you can not worry about, oh, it's just men in rubber suits and little models and things like that, and you can just go with the flow, there isn't a more entertaining Godzilla movie than this one.
Oh, is there? Stay tuned for future editions of the Kaiju Christmas, and we'll see if we can challenge that opinion of yours, Stephen. So,
challenge accepted.
Number three is a film which I describe as being the Korean version of Saving Private Ryan, but better. And that is Brotherhood, also known as Taegakki, the Brotherhood of War from 2004. This is a film which I showed to my father, and He thought it was just absolutely astounding. I said to him, you know, this is the best way I can try this. It's like, you know, it's the Korean Saving Private Ryan. And he was like, no, this is just so much better. And I think I stand by that opinion. I really, when I talk about like one of my favorite films of all times, I think Brotherhood is just head and shoulders above so many other films. And the film itself is set during the Korean War, which is probably one of the least tapped into areas of history when it comes to filmmaking. And we have these two brothers, and the older brother is determined to get his younger brother out of the army. So he engages in all these sort of suicide missions and tries to get himself promoted to earn a Medal of Honor, which he believes will enable his brother to be discharged from the army, and in turn, you know, save him from being killed on the battlefield. And the film itself, it just follows this really emotional journey. We see, obviously, the older brother being sort of becoming more drawn and darkened by the things that he's forced to see around him. And it just climaxes on this this absolutely astounding final battle sequence. And, I mean, it really shows the Korean War for what it is. I mean, this is a real blood and snot conflict. And it's perfectly captured by the finale, which is probably what just a real heartbreaking sort of sequence and a real sort of like heroic end, all in one sort of wonderful sequence. And the director is himself, Kang Ji-gu. At the time, he sort of like really sort of pushed in this wave of Korean movies that came out, and he was certainly noteworthy for the fact that he was playing with the same sort of budgets that Western directors were getting to play around with. And certainly when you look at this film, it's all on the screen. It's just an absolutely stunning portrayal of war, and it's just both like moving and just incredible. It's not a boy's own adventure sort of movie. It's just, as I said, it's a real sort of horrors of war film, and very much sort of taps into the same sort of vein of like the likes of Platoon and Saving Private Ryan. And certainly if you like your war movies like that, then I think this is one definitely worth checking out.
I don't really like war movies, but this is a really good one. And being a Korean movie, it's also got the whole family-based emotional depth to it as well, that you can connect with the characters. So yeah, wouldn't have even touched my top 100, but a really good film, and locally in South Korea, a really popular film as well. So yeah, I'll accept this entry into the list.
It's certainly one that I think we are going to discuss it deeper in more detail in a future episode. As same when we were like compiling a list of films to discuss on the show, that I think Brotherhood was definitely in there. So unquestionably, it's in my top five. And yeah, if it wasn't for the two before it, I would certainly would put it higher. So, but at number two, we have the template, you know, the high point, the high water mark, for anime, the anime which all anime are still marked against, and that is 1988's Akira, by Katsuhiro Otomo. This film came out with the tagline, Neo Tokyo is about to explode. This film really encapsulates all that is wonderful about old school anime, and the film itself is based on the 8 phone-sized volumes of manga. The film itself, it taps into a real sort of cyberpunk, post-apocalyptic Neo Tokyo, as a member of a biker gang is captured by the military and subjected to experiments which tap into his inner psychic abilities, only for him to then offer to go rogue, and put him up against his former best friend as the two battle for the fate of Neo Tokyo. The film itself is still absolutely stunning. I mean, the opening bike chase through the streets of Neo Tokyo is still an absolutely astounding sequence, and the fact it's first of all, it's shot at night, which is one of the most difficult things to animate, and there's about 47 shades of grey mixed into this sequence, but seeing how the light effects move, how bikes move, how the action flows, how these characters are sort of introduced and developed, it's just absolutely astounding. And while they constantly threaten to make a live action remake of this film, the anime is just a class of its own. It is just an absolute temple, not only of just Asian cinema, but just cinema on a whole. This is really shows you the power of what animated films can do. And it's still, as I said, it's still an anime which I measure all other anime against.
So we've never really talked about Akira, have we?
It's surprising, really.
It's never come up, because I've lived with Akira for 30 years. I remember when it came over. I had friends who used it along with films like Top Gun to show off their surround sound and their widescreen TVs. I had friends who were fans of the manga. So I think this was made before the manga was complete. I own at least 3 different versions of this movie in various formats and special editions, but I don't get it. And okay, I really want us to talk about this film in a future episode, so you can expand or I can watch it with a different eye, because I mean, it's not that I don't like cyberpunk. It's not that the elements of the film aren't things that I would normally enjoy. There's just something about it I don't connect with, and I don't know what it is. And so we need to talk about Akira. That needs to be in a future episode fairly soon.
So we're now at number one. What has really claimed the top spot on my list? And I think if you listen to our previous episode, you would know already what that film is. And at number one for myself is Battle Royale. Battle Royale is, as we mentioned before, it's not only the film which ushered in the new wave of interest in Asian cinema. It's just an absolutely perfect movie from start to start. It's absolutely astounding concept, this idea of a class of students being sent to this island to battle to the death, as part of a government reform act. has been set up to not only revitalize the Japanese economy, but also show the lengths that they're willing to do, go to combat the threat of these of children who are obviously gone rogue. The film itself is not only directed by Kichi Fukasaru, apologize if I've mispronounced that, but also features a very memorable appearance by Takashi Beat Takano. We talked about this with Emily on episode 25, and it's, I guess it's one of those films that it's, we mentioned already, I mean, on that episode, that it's a subtitle movie that's never received a dub, yet there are people who say they would never watch subtitle movies that will have watched Battle Royale. It's a really interesting take on the most dangerous game. The soundtrack is just fantastic. It's populated with very popular classics, so if you've ever seen a commercial with classical music, you'll probably find it in this movie's soundtrack. And at the same time, we have a group of 40 students here, but every character seems to have their little moment to sort of shine, be defined, and not just be fodder for the slaughter. And it's just an astounding piece of filmmaking. It was given a very problematic sequel, should we say, that I liked, bar its fair act, but Battle Royale just, I don't know how many times I watched this movie, just time and time again, it just fills me with the same sort of excitement and interest that it did the first time. And as soon as I hear the opening orchestral bars of that introduction, I just know, you know, it's Battle Royale time. I'm just going to be hooked from like start to finish of this film. But yeah, for myself, Battle Royale is my number one pick.
So you just need to go back and listen to our previous episode when me, Elwood, and Emily talk about it at great length. I'm not going to argue with you. There's maybe six films on your list that were going to be on my list. So I'm very lucky following you. I've been able to sneak six other films on and take them off. But Battle Royale would have been my top movie as well. It's a gateway movie. It's the movie that I can show people who don't like Japanese or Asian or even subtitled films. It's ridiculous but thought provoking. There's all sorts of different characters in there. We talked at great length in the previous episode about who our favourites were and the stories that we're most interested in. The novel it's based on is great. The general idea is just a bit of disturbing, but a huge amount of fun. I have problems with it. I have huge problems about the story and how it doesn't quite hang together for me, but that doesn't stop it being one of the most entertaining bits of cinema I've ever seen. So it would have been my number one as well. So yeah, absolutely, mate.
So there you have it. So that's the first half of our top 50 list. You've had my 25. On the next episode, Stephen will be showing his 25. And obviously, let us know any films that you feel that we should have included on our list. Let's hear what would have made your own list. And if anything, it will obviously give us new films to check out and hopefully spark some interesting discussion in the comment section. Until next time, though, you can obviously follow us on Twitter. We are on Facebook as well. You can check out the whole archive on asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com as well as through thatmomentin.com. You know, wherever you happen to listen to us, leave us a rating, leave us some comments. It really helps raise the show's profile and helps more people obviously discover the show. And so we thank everyone for obviously listening, and we hope that you've enjoyed this first part of our top 50 countdown. And next time we will be back with Stephen's list. But until next time, thank you as always to my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll be back next time, finding what made Stephen's top 25. Hey! 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 昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子を忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が
砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える想いを狂わすのさ昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ